and this is Saturday Morning Live. You're listening to Radio Regent, and we now go to Black Agenda Report.
When Dr. Martin Luther King died at the age of 39, he was quite clear about who and what was at the root of human suffering. He believed that racism, militarism, and extreme materialism were the giant triplets of interrelated evil that had to be overcome if society was to be transformed. Dr. King said the United States was host to all three resident evils, and that America reigned as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. 46 years later, the United States clearly leads the world in all three of Dr. King's categories of evil, and we can prove it by the numbers. It's true that racism is hard to measure, but the effects of racism can be quantified. If a racist government is defined as one that consistently uses its powers in ways that harm a particular racial group, then the U.S. is indisputably the most racist major state in the world. The U.S. prison population is by far the largest on the planet in sheer numbers and in the proportion of Americans locked up. No other country comes close, which makes the United States the superpower of mass incarceration. America's police and prison custodial forces dwarf the militaries of most countries, which tells us that militarism is now so deeply embedded in U.S. domestic structures that you can't tell where the military ends and the police begin. Nearly half of U.S. prisoners are African American, although blacks are only 1/8 of the total U.S. population. Since Americans make up fully 1/4 of the world's prison inmates, that means 1 out of every 8 prisoners on the planet is an African American. This could only occur in a thoroughly racist state whose institutions work overtime to produce the biggest and most racially unbalanced incarceration numbers on Earth. Clearly, America has racism, triple evil number one, covered. Number two is militarism. The U.S. military budget is almost as large as the military spending of all the world's other nations combined. Together, the U.S. and its NATO allies account for more than 70% of global weapons spending. At last count, the U.S. spent 6 times more on war than China and 11 times more than Russia. In fact, if you count up the U.S. and all of its allies, they are probably responsible for about 90% of all monies spent on war. Therefore, today, 46 years after Dr. King's death, the United States is not just the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. It is right at the center of just about all of the violence in the world today. Which is why a recent international poll shows that the people of the world think the U.S. is the most significant threat to peace. Finally, the third of the triple evils, extreme materialism. By that, Dr. King meant great disparities in wealth and income. According to the Swiss Global Wealth Data Book, wealth is so unevenly distributed in the United States, it no longer resembles a first world country at all. Of all the rich nations, the U.S. is dead last in terms of material equality. So, by Dr. Martin Luther King's measurements, America is in bad shape, more bedeviled by the triple evils than back in his day. In fact, things are much, much worse, because it's the silence that kills you. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, 50 years after the war on poverty, poor people's programs are under more assault than ever. It's been 43 years since the FBI's COINTELPRO secrets were revealed, and a new book asks folks to imagine what socialism would look like in the USA.
But first, the Internal Revenue Service is threatening to put IFCO, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, out of business. Gail Walker is co-director of IFCO, which funds independent community organizing and holds an annual caravan of aid to Cuba. She explains what the IRS is up to.
Once again, the IRS powers that be are coming after us. This time, they are threatening to revoke our tax-exempt status, or 501c3 nonprofit status. This follows a two-year audit by the IRS of our books, and we learned that this call for an audit was actually triggered by two members of Congress. Actually, one is a former member of Congress, a Republican from North Carolina, Sue Myrick. She's also a Tea Party supporter. And a Democrat from California by the name of Brad Sherman, who had written letters to Attorney General Eric Holder and the IRS Commissioner questioning our role in providing fiscal sponsorship for a project known as Viva Palestina. Actually, it's the U.S. component of Viva Palestina, which is a U.K.-based charity that has taken humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza. And the attack by the IRS, sort of a scathing report pulled together by the forensic investigator, also takes fault with our solidarity work with Cuba. The French shipment caravan that we have organized for the past 22 years and the support of U.S. students interested in taking advantage of the scholarship opportunities that Cuba is offering for the medical school scholarship.
Let's deal with the Gaza situation first. So they're construing that any dealings with or aid to Palestinians in Gaza is somehow support for what they have designated as a terrorist organization, Hamas.
Yeah, what they have done is made these broad arcs, these overreaching claims that by providing fiscal sponsorship with Viva Palestina, which is taking humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza, that somehow both Viva Palestina and IFCO are aiding terrorists. Hamas is the legally elected government of Gaza. So there's this attempt to kind of, with a broad stroke, also just disrespect the voice of the people of Gaza. But the point is that we were working with Viva Palestina. Viva Palestina was working with non-governmental agencies, including the Red Cross and other non-governmental organizations, to deliver this aid. This is what the project was all about. This was always the intent and what they actually were able to accomplish.
And, of course, the United Nations deals with the Palestinians of Gaza and with the government of Gaza, which is headed by Hamas, every day.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, the United Nations has announced that 2014 is the year of solidarity with the Palestinian people, I understand. So you're right. That happens all the time. And IFCO's history has been to be in support of people who have been oppressed or beleaguered by often U.S. policies. So whether that be here in the United States, in Cuba, in, you know, Chiapas, Nicaragua, Africa, and certainly in Palestine. So it's just keeping with the historical work that IFCO has always been associated with. And I think it's worth noting that the IRS has used as a pretext for claiming the connection between Viva Palestina and Hamas. They back this up by quoting a blogger by the name of Stephen Emerson, who directs the Investigative Project on Terrorism. It's a very reactionary sort of right-wing blog, and they claim that he's their terrorism expert. But there is a lot of documentation that really sort of proves that this fella has done very shoddy reporting, that his own tax-exempt status is questionable. I think it was the Charity Navigator, certainly one of those groups that really monitors nonprofit organizations, have issued an alert about his own dealings. But to have the IRS, a U.S. agency, government agency, utilize a blog to come after a legitimate 47-year-old faith-based nonprofit organization run by people of color since its inception, as the proof that somehow we are connected with aiding terrorism, is just an outrage and an insult.
Well, of course, the IRS is not a force unto itself. It's a branch of the U.S. government, as you said. So do you characterize this as an attack by the administration on IFCO?
I think that we can only look at it in that way. this is not the first time that IFCO has come under attack by U.S. government forces. The IRS has attempted to put us through long and winding audits in the past, and we've come out on top. The Treasury Department, through its Office of Foreign Assets Control, the entity in Treasury that enforces the embargo, the blockade against Cuba, has tried to come after us time and time again for our caravans of friendship with the Cuban people. There have been different efforts to try to get lists of our supporters from our bank to try to come after them. We've successfully defeated the government in those efforts. Again, that was through Treasury. So there have been time and time again where different arms of the U.S. government have attempted to try to negatively impact our work and to try to threaten our supporters. And we've been able to successfully, you know, weather those challenges. And we're fighting this attack in the same way and are confident that right will prevail and that we will be able to successfully defeat this attack.
This administration claims that it's trying to reach a rapprochement with Cuba, but this is evidence to the opposite.
Yeah, it's ironic because I think in so many ways the U.S. government's policy toward Cuba has been for many, many years inconsistent, arbitrary. Here's yet another case where on the one hand, this sort of public persona where the perception that they want to put out there is that there's an effort to work with Cuba. And then on the other hand, there are these sort of backhanded approaches to really trying to threaten organizations that have been offering friendship and trying to pursue a different policy as it relates to Cuba and educating people about this vicious impact of the U.S. blockade against Cuba. So there's this kind of contradictory, almost schizophrenic behavior or attitude when it comes to the United States and Cuba. And I think that this is another example of that at play.
IFCO is, of course, not rich. Is this putting a chill among your benefactors, your donors?
Well, you know, ironically, Glenn, it's really been the exact opposite. We've gotten people who have been calling, who've been stopping by the office, who've been writing checks and saying, we have to fight this, recognizing that an attack on IFCO of this nature is an attack on all progressive issues that many of our supporters hold dear to heart. I think that there's really a groundswell of support that has been reached as a result of this attack, and that's precisely why we think it's important to spread the word, to let people know that not only is this attack happening, but that it's unjust, it's immoral, it's unfair, and we're going to fight it. And we're counting on our supporters to help us in that regard. And they've been really kind of coming out of the woodwork.
But it is an added burden, and legal defense against the IRS does cost money.
There's no doubt about that. There is an effort to raise money. We've got to raise money for a legal defense, and that does come with its own level of burden. We think it's important for our network, our supporters, to not get detracted from the important work that needs to be done. That is the caravan that we're organizing this summer. That is the next group of medical school students that we plan to take down to Cuba. And that is the dozens of nonprofit organizations that we provide fiscal sponsorship for here in the United States to continue to lift up their work and to provide that support. So it's a challenge. It comes with an extra burden. But we think it's important for people to be aware of what the IRS is doing, but at the same time, to not allow their vicious campaign and attack to distract us, progressive-minded people, from the important work that we've been doing and need to continue to do as we move forward.
That was Gail Walker of IFCO in New York.
Boston-based United for a Fair Economy has released its annual State of the Dream report for 2014. It's titled Healthcare for Whom? Enduring Racial Disparities. The progressive think tank held a press conference with representatives of the NAACP and community organizations from Alabama, Florida, and Louisiana, states that have refused to expand their Medicaid programs under the administration's Affordable Care Act. Brian Miller is executive director of United for a Fair Economy. He says ongoing racial economic gaps also create racial health disparities.
Racial segregation and concentrated poverty effectively create a toxic soup of health problems and challenges for communities of color. Blacks and Latinos significantly lag behind whites in income and wealth. Black and Latino households hold only 13 cents of net wealth to every dollar that the median white household holds. Black and Latino families earn 64 and 63 cents, respectively, to every dollar that white families earn. Black and Latinos are more likely to be unemployed, even when taking education into account. That is, among college graduates alone, if you just limit this to those with a bachelor's degree, 6.3% of blacks, 5.1% of Latinos are unemployed, compared to only 3.7% of whites. In short, vast economic disparities are still with us, and these disparities, coupled with continued racial segregation, create a toxic soup that is brewing up health problems and shortening people's lives. Racial segregation pushes more people of color into communities of concentrated poverty. Poor blacks are 7 times as likely as poor whites. Poor Latinos are 6 times as likely as poor whites to live in high poverty neighborhoods. And these are neighborhoods that lack adequate health care facilities. They're neighborhoods that often lack a full service grocery store. You can't buy healthy food even if you wanted to without driving miles. These are communities that often lack green space or parks to walk and jog and engage in healthy activities. And even when those parks are present, high crime rates prevent parents from allowing their children to use them. They keep their children indoors as soon as they get home from school. These high poverty communities are also facing a disproportionate share of environmental toxins. There was a lot of recent reporting about the asthma epidemic from black mold. We know that these communities are subjected to higher levels of lead. We also know that they're also subjected to higher levels of industrial pollutants from the siting of facilities. The end result of all this should elicit moral outrage. Black men die an average of 5 years earlier than white men. Black women die 4 years earlier than white women. And this really goes to the core of what Dr. King says: of all forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane. We agree, and that's why we wrote this report. We have a problem in the United States. And this is where we get into issues of when things become structurally embedded in the economic system, that you don't even have to be intentional about racism, but you're still going to get racist impacts and disparate racial outcomes. And our employer-based healthcare is an example of that. One could make an argument that there's nothing inherently racist, there's nothing intentionally racist, at least, in an employer-based healthcare model. It's just a model for healthcare. But because that healthcare model is built on top of another system that we know has a lot of documented racism, the job sector, we get racial outcomes. That is, in the employment sector, we know that people with black-sounding resumes are going to get shuffled to the bottom of the stack. We know that people of color are going to less likely to be considered for managerial positions. We know that a host of factors keep people of color out of significant job opportunities. As a result, black and Latino households are more likely to work minimum wage jobs, part-time jobs, low-wage jobs, temporary jobs, and non-managerial jobs, all of which are less likely to provide health insurance for communities of color. And as a result, communities of color, Latinos, and African Americans lag significantly behind whites in their coverage rates. And the only way we're going to ever fix it entirely is with a single-payer system. And if you look at Medicare for 65 and older, there is essentially no disparities between black and white and Latino in health insurance coverage once you limit it to 65 and older, because that's essentially a single-payer system. It's no longer dependent on the employment sector. Now, the Affordable Care Act obviously doesn't go that far, but it does make really positive progress towards closing the vast racial disparities in health insurance. It does it through a number of measures, including the health exchanges, which we've all heard about, but more importantly, through the expansion of the Medicaid program for all adults, whether they have children or not, and their children, obviously, up to 138% of poverty. This is a huge addition to the Medicaid program that's going to insure a lot of people, millions of people, 10 million people who previously would not have had insurance. Unfortunately, even that is under attack by the opponents of the Affordable Care Act, which is commonly known as Obamacare. We now have 25 states that are not going to be expanding their Medicaid program under the ACA in 2014. All but 3 of those are headed by Republican governors. So we now have this, what we call the 25-state coverage gap, through which 5 million Americans will now fall. These are people who are predominantly people of color. Blacks make up only 13% of the nation's population, but they account for 27% of those who are going to fall through the new 25-state coverage gap. And this is in part because every state in the South where large numbers of African Americans live, with the exception of Arkansas, is rejecting Medicaid expansion. That needs to be fixed. Latinos make up about 15% of the population. Once you take out undocumented immigrants, you're looking at 15% of the population. Yet they account for 21% of those who fall through the new 25-state coverage gap. This is in part because of the decisions of both Texas and Florida to not expand their Medicaid program. In fact, 1 million of the 5 million people, or nearly 5 million, who will go without insurance now, live in Texas. And that's a state that's 38% Latino. So what we are seeing is this 25-state coverage gap and the attack on the Affordable Care Act is disproportionately hitting communities of color.
Your emphasis is on defending the Affordable Care Act. Much of your report concerns the benefits of Medicaid expansion and talks about the great deficits that result from those 25 states that have opted out of Medicaid expansion. Doesn't all of this dramatize the necessity to demand a real single-payer program?
As United for Free Economy, we unapologetically support, you know, single-payer. That's what we need to do, Medicare for all. That said, we know that may be a far-off challenge, and there are policy changes that can be made right now that will make a profound difference in people's lives. And I, for one, am not going to be so ideologically pure that we let people suffer in the here and now because it isn't as perfect as we would like it to be. So, yes, we're supporting the Medicaid expansion in those 25 states and doing everything we can to support those efforts to close that 25-state coverage gap. And at the same time, though, we're supporting states like Vermont and encouraging other states to go further if it's within the political possibilities of their state.
Brian Miller, Executive Director of United for a Fair Economy in Boston.
This marks the 50th year since President Lyndon Johnson declared war on poverty. We spoke with several experts on the poverty programs of that era. Annalise Orlock is a professor of history at Dartmouth University and co-editor of the book, The War on Poverty, A Grassroots History, 1964 through 1980. Half a century ago and today, opponents of Poor People's Program say that throwing money at poverty program doesn't work. But Professor Orlock says the war on poverty was a great success.
No, they work and they work very well and they tend to work very quickly. So that within a decade after Lyndon Johnson had initiated war on poverty programs, the child poverty rate was cut in half. From that time to 2012, the poverty rate was cut by something like 40%. Now, the right likes to say that there are more poor people now than there were before the programs went into existence. That is true numerically. There are also a larger number of people in the population. So the other thing is that the measure of poverty is a little bit off. And if you measure poverty accurately and you don't take people out of the ranks of the impoverished if they're receiving poverty programs, right? You admit that those who are receiving poverty aid get it because they're poor, then we find also that the impact of those programs has been tremendous. And qualitatively, it's been tremendous. So what I mean by that is that before the war on poverty, you had no food stamps program, you had no women and infant children nutrition program and medical care, you had no Medicaid and Medicare. And the introduction of all those programs has meant that we don't see the signs of poverty that we did before. We don't see long-term malnutrition. We don't see rickets and soft bones and open sores and, you know, some of the kinds of mental deficits that we did as a result of long-term malnutrition. All those, in my mind, are dramatic successes. The community health care program actually expanded life expectancies in poor neighborhoods. People literally live longer than before the community health centers were first opened up. And finally, poor people got involved in the political process. And that's something we've seen less of since the programs have been cut, because frankly, that made a lot of politicians run scared. It shook things up when poor people got involved in the political process and demanded representation on school boards and housing boards and welfare boards and even started to run for office and register other poor people to vote. All of those things shook up the political establishment, and so one of the reasons that it's so popular to attack the war on poverty is not because it failed, but because it succeeded.
Yes, and with poor people not organizing today in the numbers that we saw in the 60s in defense of their economic rights, it seems only to encourage the austerity forces.
Yeah, I think that that's really true. One of the things that was powerful about Lyndon Johnson's declaration of a war on poverty 50 years ago is that it made poor people feel that it was indeed a moral imperative for the country to try to fight poverty. And the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964 required, quote-unquote, maximum feasible participation by the poor themselves. And so even though we have a lot of the same services now, we have the medical care where it wasn't before and the libraries where they weren't before, we in the community service agencies, we don't have poor people getting involved to the same degree. And the government can promote that, and it's successful. And it acknowledges that poor people know what their communities need. And if we recruit them and give them a little bit of income to provide services to their communities, that they actually do a pretty good job of it.
You're the author of a book called Storming Caesar's Palace, How Black Mothers Fought Their Own War on Poverty. Now, of course, blacks have never made up the majority of people in poverty, but black folks certainly took the leadership role in fighting against poverty.
Exactly. And black women were very much the leaders of anti-poverty work in the 1960s. The National Welfare Rights Organization and a lot of the local branches of the welfare rights struggle. And in that role, they did a number of things. First of all, even after Congress passed the Food Stamp Act and free lunch and breakfast programs in the schools had been on the books since the 40s, but in all of these cases, women and infant children nutrition program as well, in all of these cases, the money was not released to the state. The programs were passed, but they weren't funded. Poor mothers sued, and a lot of them were poor black mothers who sued in states across the country to release funding for those programs, and then they did organizing to educate people across lines of race and gender that they were eligible, they were entitled to get food stamps, to have their children screened for illnesses and treated for free if the screening showed that they needed it. And they opened clinics. They ran community newspapers. They did tremendous work in making the war on poverty a vibrant success. And so we owe that generation of single mothers, but definitely, especially black single mothers, a real debt of gratitude.
The National Welfare Rights Organization used to be in the news, it looked like, every day. What happened to the NWRO, and has any other group or groups emerged to fill the void?
Well, the National Welfare Rights Organization began to lose its funding when the charismatic male leader, a chemistry professor by the name of George Wiley, died in the early 70s in a boating accident. And he was kind of the middle-class voice of the movement and the charismatic male voice of the movement. And he was very good at tapping funders. And when the movement was actually run by poor women themselves, and particularly by women from Los Angeles named Johnny Tillman and from New York named Eula Sanders, they didn't get the kind of funds that they were getting before, and so the organization drifted and dwindled and ultimately went under in 1975. However, into the 80s and 90s, you had these local organizations that continued tapping into war on poverty programs, and the Comprehensive Education and Training Act, CETA, originally passed under Richard Nixon, and the Youth Employment Training Program. They started local agencies to hire people in their communities, and sometimes they were the biggest employers in their communities, getting people off the welfare rolls and into little jobs of various kinds in their communities. In the years since those particular programs were repealed, it's been harder for poor people's organizations to keep going, but there are still welfare rights organizations. They sometimes talk to each other on the web. On the eve of the 1996 Welfare Reform Act, there were Have a Heart demonstrations on Valentine's Day with poor mothers and their kids in state capitals across the country. But there was not a whole lot of media coverage, so we don't realize it. And I think I think the Navy was more sympathetic to NWRO in its heyday, and that's one reason we knew about it and we don't know about what's going on now. But there's definitely important things going on now on the community level in many parts of the country. There's organizing among college students on welfare in the City University of New York system. Their numbers are nearly 30,000. And so I think we do see some important organizing going on now, and we have to find ways to publicize it.
And yet today, even the word welfare is one that, even liberals avoid.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely true. And that was one of Ronald Reagan's great successes. He didn't actually, as president, repeal most of the War on Poverty programs, even though he promised to. And in some cases, like the Earned Income Tax Credit, he actually expanded. George W. Bush expanded the food stamp program, now known as SNAP, more than any other president since the War on Poverty days. But the rhetoric is to attack poor single mothers and people on welfare as somehow, you know, parasitical and fraudulent. And the truth is that the evidence never bore that out. It never did. It never showed that there was a great deal of cheating. People did what they could and what they needed to survive. I'm sure sometimes there was cheating, but certainly less than you find in the corporate sector, certainly less than, you know, we found on Wall Street in 2008 and, you know, in the defense industry. So I think that's the big success of the Reagan Revolution, and I think it's something that we have to fight against. Got to use the P word, poverty. Got to honor poor single mothers for trying to take care of their kids and not blame them for seeking a little government assistance doing so. I mean, you know, what do we pay taxes for?
And in fact, it's hard work being poor.
It's such hard work. It's such hard work. And, you know, it's really been an eye-opener for me to now live in a rural area where I teach. And I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I thought I understood poverty there. It's a whole different thing here. And I think also very invisible. People living on back roads, you know, sometimes without telephones, without cars. It's hard work. It's exhausting. And being stigmatized on top of that makes it all that much harder for people to get out of poverty. It's one of the reasons the War on Poverty was so great, by getting people involved in their communities. And I interview people in the movement. They talk about feeling like they mattered in those days and they could help other people. And that gave them emotional strength and the sense of self to, you know, to pull themselves up a little bit. Well, there are many programs that still exist from the War on Poverty years, most of the big ones. What we don't have is an ability to talk about public jobs. And public jobs programs are something that even Lyndon Johnson shied away from. Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter and the Congresses that were passing legislation in their day were a little more willing to look at it. You know, it was a time when Coretta Scott King and Ruby Duncan, who I write about in the Las Vegas movement, they were lobbying for full employment. And I think we need to go back to thinking about that, because government jobs programs also work. They worked in the New Deal era. They contributed a great deal, even if they didn't end the Depression, they contributed a great deal to our society, and they gave people some economic security through work. And I think that that's a direction that we really need to look at. There's an awful lot that needs to be done in our country, from infrastructure to mentoring of young children to rebuilding our schools and hospitals. And I think that we can turn again to this idea of public jobs programs, I think particularly among young people. So many communities, the rate of unemployed young people is just devastatingly high. That's not good for anybody. It's certainly not good for the future of our society as a whole. So that's one direction that I'd really like to see us go as we commemorate the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty.
That was Professor Annalise Orlick at Dartmouth University in New Hampshire.